everyone. This is Ankita Bharadwaj, your host for Subtle Desi Traits, and you are listening to WORT Madison 89.9 FM. Our guest today is Lisa Imhoff. Lisa Imhoff, who uses she/her pronouns, is a licensed clinical social worker with over 15 years of experience providing mental health counseling to adolescents, families, college students, and adults. For as long as she can remember, Lisa has always been attuned to the issues of equity and justice. She's worked with domestic abuse survivors, people who've experienced incarceration, and people and populations who routinely experience exclusion and marginalization. She believes her orientation towards equity, inclusion, and justice comes from some of her own lived experiences growing up in Madison as a low-income, mixed-race individual, daughter of a refugee, and first-generation college student and career professional. Trained as a social worker, Lisa is interested in identifying and facilitating behavior change at the individual and systemic levels. This interest in systems work propelled her to change career direction in 2019. She currently works as an associate dean for diversity, equity, and inclusion at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Pharmacy, where she advances and supports individual and organizational development and change to promote access, equity, inclusion, and well-being for all. In 2022, Lisa was recognized by Madison 365 as one of the Wisconsin's most influential Asian American leaders. And guess what? This is AAPI Heritage Month, and so this is a perfect guest that I thought would be amazing to interview for this month. So, let's get to it. So, we have Lisa in the studio with us today. Lisa, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm a little tired, not gonna lie.
I get that. These days have been interestingly weird because sometimes they're rainy and dark and sometimes they're sunny. You don't know what's happening.
Yeah, this is not what I was expecting.
Yeah, so Lisa, the reason I invited you to the studio is because I know you are a therapist, right? And you've been a therapist for how many years?
So I got my social work license, or no, so I got my social work degree in 2005, but I've been practicing in therapy since 2003.
Oh, wow. Yeah. 21 years, right?
Yeah. But I actually have not really been actively practicing since 2020, since I got a new job at the university.
Yeah. But give or take, you have like around 15 or 16 years of experience in the field.
Yeah. I'd say that's fair.
Yeah. That's a lot. And I'm pretty sure during your time as a therapist, you came across clients who were of marginalized identities, like people of color, you know, queer people, immigrants, you know, women, children. Did you ever feel like there was like a theme of like issues, like mental health concerns that people of marginalized identities often faced?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in my first part of my career, I was working at UW Health. And it was called the Adolescent Intervention Program. I'm really abbreviating. It's much longer than that. but what we served there were adolescents, and many of them were in the juvenile justice system. Mm-hmm. So by way of living in Dane County, many of the adolescents in the juvenile justice system also happened to be adolescents of color. Mm. So that some themes I saw there were like not equal access to mental health services. So a lot of my advocacy back then was like, we need to go into, we need to go where people are at. So I would see kids up at the juvenile reception center. I would see them in their homes. I would go into the high schools because I thought access is a huge issue. And if we can't, if they can't get to counseling, I mean, that's not going to help them heal and get out of the situations they were in. And then also, another theme was just having mental health counseling from counselors that understood their experience. So really culturally responsive programming, therapy that understood kind of their worldview. I mean, some of mental health therapy and the paradigm is really built on kind of, I want to say, well, white people or like yeah. privileged white people, right? Mm-hmm. So kind of breaking down some of the, I guess there's like, there is elitism in mental health,
oh, yeah.
right? So
oh, yeah.
like kind of getting on people's level. So that was at UW Health Adolescent Intervention Program and being, of course, developmentally appropriate with adolescents. And then I also would do family therapy too. Mm-hmm. But then I worked at University Health Services with college students, and themes I saw there for people with marginalized identities, more BIPOC individuals, were really a lack of well-being due to systems of oppression. So kind of operating in systems that are inherently not representative of their experience, maybe a lack of access, maybe mm-hmm. exclusion mm. within the school or work setting, bias, microaggressions were common themes, identity, just mm-hmm. kind of grappling with identity, especially in a town that's predominantly white and then at a university that's predominantly white. So a range of issues.
Range of issues.
yeah.
I can see
yeah.
you've worked with a lot of folks. But yeah. something that caught my attention is when you talked about cultural literacy amongst therapists, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I cannot tell you how much I agree with it, right? Because, like, a lot of folks, like, our experiences are based on how we see the world mm-hmm. and what our relationship is with other people and how we perceive those relationships mm-hmm. and somebody that comes from a different culture, I see so many different things in a different way, everyday things like transport or friendships, you know, or my relationship when I was in law school with my professor, how I saw teachers, how my culture sees teachers mm-hmm. versus how teachers are perceived here. Those are two vastly different things. And I feel like that is absent in mental health therapists. Do you think that is something that men, like, you know, schools that give out degrees for mental health mm-hmm. need to work on, or is it human beings or therapists themselves have to work on it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, ideally you would get that in the curriculum and in your educational experience. It's been a while since I've been in mm-hmm. my educational program, so I would hope that there's more of an emphasis on, like, this isn't a one-size-fits-all model, that people are varied in their experiences, that we have to consider different cultural contexts. So I honestly think, though, you experience that more by doing and being with different people. And then I think it's incumbent on therapists to go get the knowledge that they don't have, that they're going to uncover the areas where they need more growth, because they're going to encounter an individual mm-hmm. that they don't understand or they think they understand. But you have to have enough cultural humility to know, like, okay, I really don't understand that experience. But if we have some therapists, though, that will take that expert stance and not be aware, mm-hmm, and they're mm-hmm. going to miss the mark, right? But they're going to think it's the client and not them.
Hmm.
So then it's going to be like, oh, they weren't adhering to therapy, or, you know what I mean? Unless they're, like, super self-aware.
Yeah, I mean, full disclosure, I've been to therapy. I still go to therapy. I think it's amazing. Everybody should go to therapy. It's just like having a paid friend who has to listen to you.
You can't escape.
Can't escape. It's a closed room. And, and they can't even tell anybody because, you know, HIPAA and stuff.
Right. Sometimes they have panic buttons, though, in case.
Oh, God, Jesus. Wait, for the patient or the client?
It's for them, their safety. Help, get me out of here.
All right, I didn't know that. I might want to ask my therapist next, what's your panic button? I mean, just out of curiosity, where is your panic button? I don't think she'll tell me.
I mean, we had them, but we were with, like, you University know, Health Services, yes, and UW Health. They had the money to pay for that.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. A lot of organizations don't. But yeah, coming back to the point that, yes, I've gone to a lot of therapy, and there's always this, like, feeling, like, I have come across a lot of therapists where I felt like if they told me to do something and for some whatever reason I couldn't do it, then because I've not been able to do it, then it's my fault and I'm coming in the way of my own healing. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. like, for example, many years ago, one of my therapists, no longer a therapist, she was a therapist for like one session for a reason, but she was like, you should journal. And I do not like journaling. Mm-hmm. Because I've written two theses. I genuinely do not want to write if I don't have to.
Right.
Right. I really don't have notebooks at my place. I mean, I have a laptop and stuff, but I don't
have
a notebook.
Yeah.
I have like maybe one pen.
Okay.
Yeah, and that too, AT&T gifted it to me. This is not an advertisement for AT&T. Just let me tell you this. But yeah, I just have one pen.
I have some pens for you.
Thank you. I would love that. But yeah, she said, oh, if you can't journal, then we can really help you. Like, straight up. And yeah, it was kind of, I don't know, did not sit well with me. Mm-hmm. But there are people out there who can do advocacy for themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure some of them are maybe listening to us right now. Mm-hmm. What would you suggest that they do if they come across a therapist that mm-hmm. isn't really listening to them, mm-hmm. you yeah. know?
I mean, maybe even before that point, I encourage folks to, I guess, interview therapists for potential fit. So a lot of therapists, especially, and this is maybe more private practice, but you can kind of talk with them for 15 minutes, get a sense of your kind of jiving, like you like there's, you know, maybe have them explain their therapy style with you, kind of share some of why you might be coming to therapy, just to get a feel for them, I think is really that if you can do that first. But then otherwise, you know, I would actually bring that up with the therapist. Like, I'm not maybe getting what I'm needing, explaining and trying to work it through with the therapist, I think is first stop, because you've already invested connecting and probably sharing a lot of whatever it is that brought you there.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing if they're able to shift or adapt. But if you're not noticing immediate shifts, then I'm, you know, you got to peace out. And I'd say don't waste your time then, right? Like, you need to move on and find someone that can help you.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, I don't think it's even in the private practices, because I've come across a few private practice therapists, and even for the first session they charge, and usually the first session is longer than their usual session, you know, because they're taking patient history, you know, learning why you are there, why you are in therapy first in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that could be a access issue, because like if you're paying like $200 for the first session to just figure out if it's even a good fit.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like this is going to be a difficult question, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Have there been any, first of all, have you, and I'm going to be very particular about this, have you ever, I mean, I'm pretty sure your answer is yes, but like, have you ever treated immigrants as your patients? And if there were any recurring themes or issues that people who don't have citizenship status go through?
For sure. So I think my first career experience at UW Health. So I did see many families that were undocumented. And of course, there's just that underlying anxiety, just not having citizenship status, right? Like being pulled over by the police. I recall several adults and family members that couldn't really transport their kids because they didn't have a license. And so that just made things difficult for the family, right? So, and then I feel like, I want to say like 2018 or 2019, there were ICE raids happening.
Yes, I remember.
In Madison, yeah. And I think that just increased anxiety. So I just think, you know, that is obviously an issue, being fearful that someone's going to report you or getting a job. You know, it's just like it's a barrier in itself. So I just think that creates a sense of anxiety on its own. And then at University Health Services, we have a lot of international students.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them, you know, they're paying a lot for an education, a significant amount of money. And then many want to get job experience in the States. And it's very, very competitive to get sponsorship from companies and organizations. And so there's an anxiety there in terms of wanting to stay and get experience, but not always having, I guess, the opportunity, because companies are pretty limited in who can sponsor.
It's like $5,000 to sponsor a person.
Oh, wow.
I mean, used to be, I don't know what is the rate right now.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I didn't even know there was a cost associated with it. So I feel like that just created a sense of anxiety and competition, because you had international students applying for similar jobs, right? So I just think anxiety was a huge worry for many of international students that wanted to stay in the U.S. and work.
What about culture shock?
Coming to...
Yeah. You know, as international students, like...
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I was culturally shocked for multiple years. But did you have students come and, you know, talk to you about culture shock? Because a lot of times when people are going through culture shock, they don't even know that's culture shock.
Yep. I definitely had many, because students were from all over, all like Middle East, Asia, Africa. So yeah, they didn't necessarily maybe know what was happening. Some had an acute awareness just because they were able to name what was happening, and then we can name it more quickly. Like, this is culture shock. And it shows up very differently for different people depending on their, familiarity with American culture. And sometimes, you know, American culture can seep into other countries already, and there's like this, they see stuff on TV. But it definitely varied among individuals. But yeah, that's a significant theme that came up. Also, though, with not people from different countries, but students who were BIPOC in the U.S. or even different states, they would come to University of Wisconsin-Madison, and they had culture shock because it was predominantly white. So they might be coming from communities where it was really, really diverse.
Like California.
California, Chicago, Chicago. Milwaukee, even Milwaukee. And they'd be like, what?
I did not see that in my orientation.
Right? And then, you know, and when you get your tour visits, sometimes they show you the very diverse parts of campus, right?
Yeah, fair enough.
And then you're like, oh, that wasn't really the
That was like
experience.
One division.
Right, right, right. Yes, yes. So that definitely...
probably engineering.
Yeah.
I'm Indian, I can say that.
Funny.
Talking about a little bit more about, you know, international students. I mean, because this is AAPI Month special, were there like something, like some themes or some mental health issues that were specific to Asian populations? And if so, what were they?
I would say, so first of all, and I think I should disclose, I'm half Asian, and my positionality, I'm also half white, so I don't have the full, it's a different experience. But I would say for myself, I am a daughter of a refugee immigrant, and I think coming from different countries where there is many wars, there could be colonization happening, there's a lot of generational trauma, and that trauma gets passed down to, you know, their children. And so I think navigating some of the trauma within families is a prevalent theme, but then also this idea of sometimes in different cultures and different countries, they don't talk about mental health, right? Or it's seen as a weakness, right? So I think navigating your own sense of like, I'm not feeling well, I'm not, my mental health isn't 100%, and then not having that validation maybe from family members, or maybe that's a source of, you know, not being well, that the family. So that, I think that is a, it's not, you know, I don't want to paint anything as a monolith, but I would say
I see what you're saying.
It's a prevalent, I would say, theme within Asian culture is trauma. And then, especially if you're like, your parents lived in a different country and then you're living in the United States, having these different cultural experiences and navigating that. There's a lot of identity stuff, I think, tied up in that.
Yeah, I mean, growing up in India, if you were even remotely considered to be going to therapy or getting any kind of mental health attention, you were immediately at the risk of being socially ostracized. And your neighbors would talk and the aunties would talk. I mean, at least in India, you know. South Asia also, I might say there's kind of a lot of similarity in the culture of South Asian countries. And this is not necessarily limited to India. And so, yeah, I feel like Asian cultures, again, not a monolith by any extent. But there is a pushback against talking about mental health for sure, and it's considered a taboo.
It's a taboo, and it makes me wonder. I mean, and my mom, you know, her experience is very different than mine. She grew up, you know, in a country that was not fully developed. Not, you know, she was very poor, in and out of the countryside, war torn, and maybe there's just not time to think about your mental health because you're in survival mode. So I'm trying to like have empathy, and there's not language for it necessarily either. So I think if you don't have language to make sense of what you're experiencing and you're just grateful to be alive or to have food, it's just a different baseline, right? So, but then it can be invalidating then of, let's say, your children's experience in a different country where there is a lot more privilege and there is a more focus on well-being. So it's just, it's pretty fascinating when I think about it.
You know what else is fascinating? We call it mental health over here, and it's a pretty kind of nice word compared to what we have back home in India. Mm-hmm. Like, so for some, for example, if somebody's suffering from depression or anxiety, right? There's a word we would call them pagal, which has a very negative connotation to it. Like somebody who is not in control of it, of their, faculties. And to an extent where they're not even a functional human being, where, you know, where it's not that case. You're talking about depression and anxiety, and it can be debilitating.
Right.
But it's one thing to show, to show like movies. I mean, I don't know if you've seen Bollywood movies, but in the 90s and the 80s, there would always be characters where they don't, they're not in the, in control of their faculties, and they're just shown as this person who's not doing great, and then we'll be like, this is the poster child for mental health, you know?
So caricatures almost, like really kind of extreme examples.
Yes, okay. Extreme examples. Yeah. And so people who are not extreme, they'd be like, okay.
I don't want to be associated with, right? Like,
Yeah. I will lose friends. I will lose my job. Nobody would talk to me. And India is a very social country, so there's no room for that.
Sure.
Talking about U.S., coming back to the U.S., where we are, we see United States is so divided. Like, I do not know. I mean, yes, I think there have been instances in the past where United States was divided. But I feel like right now we are probably the most divided we've ever been, specifically on political and social situations, economic too. How does all of this, this changing political and stressful political environment show up, at, mental health-wise in individuals of marginalized populations?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of was in the thick of it with, you know, Trump being elected in 2016. I remember post-election how many sessions I had with people of color and other marginalized identities of the grief, trauma, and shock of him being elected and having to endure at least 4 years of his presidency. I mean, we saw increase in hate speech, hate crimes. I mean, COVID even, like, exacerbated, you know, hate crimes against Asian Americans and Asians and internationals. It's been interesting, and it's been interesting because I shifted careers into doing diversity, equity, and inclusion work. So seeing, you know, now realizing that some of this was really backlash to Barack Obama's presidency. And
How did a black man become a president, huh? How dare you?
How dare you? And so this significant backlash, right, and this uprising of more open hate and bias that probably was already there, but really kind of spurred on by having a black man in power. So definitely, I think it's been nonstop, I think, in terms of the news cycle, like I said, the hate crimes, ongoing attacks on just the work that, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion work.
Yeah.
I honestly think many of us are traumatized a bit.
Yeah.
I don't think we talk about it in those terms. It's survival, right? Like, you have to keep on going. And it's almost, you have to detach a little bit, because if you got, how could you kind of, it's almost like, how can this all be real? Because this is an attack against who I am as a person. And how do you negotiate someone actually not caring for your livelihood? I mean, and thriving. I don't know. It's a huge topic.
I also have, and I know this will be so interesting too, I have seen a shift in memes on Facebook. As a millennial, pre-pandemic and pre-Trump, the memes were of a different nature. They were not as existential as they are now. Like, people overthinking the solar eclipse, for example.
True. Yes.
Right?
Yes, like it was the apocalypse or like we're all going to die.
Yeah.
That's true. There's a little bit more sense of dread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not like we've never had eclipses before. Mm-hmm. I mean, we knew the science behind it. We've
right.
always known the science. Well, not always, but for centuries known the science behind it.
Yeah.
But everything that happens, there's an existential threat, perceived mm-hmm. existential threat to it.
Yeah.
But I also feel there are so many things happening for the first time that had never happened before. For example, the Trump criminal trial
mm-hmm.
Of the first ever against a, you know, past U.S. president.
Yep.
Do you think things like that just add fuel to the fire
mm-hmm.
mental health wise?
To be honest, now I'm going to show myself a little bit. I didn't follow the Trump trial a little bit at all.
I mean, it's still in the jury selection.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, good.
I know you have a legal background. So I think, to be honest, I used to be really politically engaged, but I've lost, and I think many people have lost trust in, you know, our political leaders, our leadership in general. I think there's just more critique.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our systems are kind of showing themselves that they're not working. Many of our systems aren't working. So in some ways, while I think we're all tired and traumatized, I also think a lot of people are taking their power back by kind of examining these systems and being critical of these systems. So I kind of see some reclaiming of power and pushing back against the establishment,
mm-hmm.
which is just fascinating to me, too, mm-hmm. in terms of an empowerment. Like, you see more community building, I think.
Mm-hmm. No, I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You think that's our, you know, human way of trying to dissociate, like you said?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think some of it's dissociating from what's not healthy. What's mm-hmm. happening around us is not healthy. And I think we've been gaslit for so long in terms of accepting just the status quo. Like, this is normal, and it was working in air quotes, for some time. But I think COVID, honestly, really showed how many of our systems, and we aren't working. There's not a lot of safety nets in place, right? So I think there's this dissociation, but then I also think there's some power being, like, even celebrities are kind of, they're having their downfall. Like, I just feel like there's just more questioning happening. And that also can be scary because you're like, okay, everything I thought I knew isn't true, or it isn't as secure as I thought things were, or people don't have my best interest at heart.
Yeah.
So that can be destabilizing too. So I just think there's a lot of uncertainty, maybe?
Agitation.
I mean, people deal with uncertainty in different ways. It could be like agitation. It could be just going inward. Like, it looks really
some
different.
Of them dissociate. Some of them are like, you know what? I'm not going to watch news
yep.
for like X amount of time.
Yep. Yep.
And that way they can at least pretend that these things are not happening even when they are.
Right. Right.
But I don't think that's healthy, right?
I don't think I was thinking about news consumption. I think it's really important to be intentional about, okay, what am I consuming? Why am I consuming it? And how does this align with my life, my values? Like, how does it benefit me or not benefit me? So being really critical of, like, why you might be engaging in, like, news or, you know, everything that's happening around us. Because the media is there to, you know, create a news cycle, right?
Like, yeah.
It's there for consumption, and I think we need to be responsible consumers even of media and news that's happening around us.
News industrial complex.
Yep.
New word.
Yeah.
Activated.
It's a thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely is a thing, for real.
Mm-hmm.
Given how many news sources we have, not just American but also abroad, for mm-hmm. example, Palestine and Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have Al Jazeera, we have the Indian network channels
mm-hmm.
like India TV, Aaj
mm-hmm.
Tak, and then we have NBC,
mm-hmm.
ABC, you know, Fox News and whatnot, and they all have their own stories
mm-hmm.
and their own
bias.
Interpretations and biases.
Mm-hmm.
It's so confusing
mm-hmm.
to even figure out at one point, like, what is the reality? And that, I feel like, at least for me, is like overwhelming
mm-hmm.
and I have seen that if I consume a lot of it stresses me out.
Oh, sure.
Like, it physically you know, shows itself. Like, I feel more tired,
mm-hmm.
just stressed out.
Yeah.
And I feel like I should probably figure out a coping mechanism. And so asking you, what do you think should be a healthy coping mechanism for folks like me?
I mean, I think to reflect on why. First, why might you be consuming all of these different news sources? Is it to be informed? Is it to tease out bias? Is it to kind of get a neutral viewpoint? And then being like, and then asking yourself, is this helping me? Like, how do I feel after?
Like you said, yeah.
Reflecting a little bit, there's definitely a balance. And how much more information do you need to know to make a decision or to be informed, right? Like, sometimes it's just, like, I'm guilty of this too. I want to know more. I want to have all the information. I want to just know, yeah, what's out there. But there's really, it doesn't sometimes, you get the more information and you feel more informed, but what actually changes as a result of it?
Yeah, like, okay, I know more, but what am I doing to change it? If I'm not doing anything to change it, then maybe I'm harming myself, you know? Mm-hmm. I watched, well, I don't want to say I harmed myself, but I metaphorically might have today, when I watched the movie Civil War.
So that's pretty deep. You watch that?
I know. I mean, I should have realized it's named Civil War, you know? Did you watch it?
Maybe. Is it an older movie that
It's a recent one that's literally just released, I think, a few weeks ago. It has Jesse Plemons and Kirsten Dunst and, you know, it's a new movie.
Okay.
But it's basically about this president of the United States who has claimed a third term.
Oh, sounds something like that could happen.
Fingers crossed. And it's basically a dystopian movie where they are showing the world where the president has claimed a third term, disbanded the FBI, and now there are two sides at war with each other.
Within
America. Okay. Yeah.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. And to cap it all, as if that was not enough, I mean, there was so much, aggression and everything, but to cap it off, there was this one scene that's like, okay, well, I think I should just pack my bags and I don't know, leave somewhere, where there was this guy who suddenly comes face to face, and I'm not trying to give you any spoilers, but it's just going to be in the theaters for the next 2 days, so you know what, whatever. But there was a scene where there's a soldier, American soldier, in soldier uniform, that shoots a guy after asking him, where are you from? He asks the people with him, and they all say, I'm from Florida, Colorado, Missouri. And then he asks that person, where are you from? And he's crying and crying and not able to answer. And finally he answers, he says, Hong Kong. And the soldier says, so you mean China, and shoots him.
Wow.
I was like, great. So if Civil War comes, my mental health is messed up.
Yeah, wow, that's intense.
Yeah, this movie was not going to do me any favors. No. I should have just known. So, talking about advice, now that I'm asking you a lot of advice, what would you suggest outside of the news cycles and what's happening around us? But, like, what advice would you give people of color specifically when it comes to our mental health? Like, what are some of the things we should do every day?
Every day.
Rejuvenate ourselves, like some practices we should follow, into our routine, inculcate it into our routine.
Ooh, okay. Well, I don't want to be cliche, but I do think there's basic things we can do to just ensure that we're going to be at our optimal best. So, getting as much sleep as you can possibly. So setting, just having that sleep hygiene where you have the set schedule, right? You're not staying up on your phone all night. I mean, I've done it, so I'm guilty of it. But you suffer. You pay for it the next day, right? I always tell the students to hydrate, like drink water. A lot of this is, we can't separate some of the physical with the mental health, right? I think there, and I hate it when people would talk about it because I'm like, you're taking away from the mental health aspect. But there is science to show that, if you're not eating healthy foods, it can affect kind of the feel-good chemicals in your brain, right? Mm-hmm. If you're imbalanced in your diet, let's see. Some of this too is thinking about your choices, your everyday choices, and are they choices that make you feel good? Are they in alignment with who you want to be, your personal values. Who do you choose to spend your time with?
Mm-hmm.
Do they make you feel good or are they draining?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like thinking about where our energy is very precious, and thinking about how we expend that energy, who we give our energy to, who gives us energy,
mm-hmm.
this positive energy. Like I really think now more than ever, we need to be super careful with our boundaries and who we let into our circles. So I try to let people that make me laugh in my circle, validate my experience, right? Understand my experience, see me. If I spend time trying to prove my existence, my worth, my ideas, it's just that's soul sucking and energy sucking. So,
yeah,
I think.
And also, like, maybe argue less on Facebook.
Yeah, don't do that.
And Twitter. Oh, sorry, X.
Are you on X?
I keep forgetting it's called X.
Yes,
I am on X, but I rarely go there.
Good.
I go there like once a month just to kind of just like see what's up, what's mm-hmm. not.
Yeah.
Sometimes I post my show there.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah, but
you're not engaging, no.
I mean, sometimes I do, you know, like once in a blue moon, but then I'm just like not there. Yeah. I have an account, but
yeah. No, yeah. I know people and they'll send me stuff that they're posting on X or Twitter and I'm just like, why?
Wait.
Yeah.
They sent you their own posts?
But they'll tell me about exchanges that they've had with other people.
Why?
I think they're trying to show that they're engaged and that they care. But I think they don't realize that it's kind of futile. Like, you don't really gain much by... No one's going to hear you, really. If they already disagree with you and they don't know you and you don't have a relationship, I don't think it really makes a difference.
Yeah.
But...
I once heard accountability happens in relationships only.
I like that.
Yeah. And on Facebook, we don't know who's on the other end. We've never met them. And you can go back and forth with them for like 100 years. And I have personally, and now I don't do it. Well, at least I try not to do it. But I've tried to change people's minds and they never change it.
Mm-hmm.
We end up just being personally insulting to each other.
Right.
And then we are anxious.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, you get fired up and you feel like crap after those exchanges, I think.
Yeah, and I don't remember who said this, but somebody also told me that the way social media is designed these days, what was the word? I think it was called anger industrial complex, something like that, that they benefit off of people's anger and frustration. Like, their media, their platform works if people are frustrated and angry.
Interesting.
Yeah, like, for example... People comment more when there's a controversial post.
Oh, sure.
You know, or like something that is politically out there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that also makes me very sad.
Well, I mean, a lot of these things that are negative do feed on our negative emotions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't think we're always aware of that.
No, we're not.
Yeah.
Finally, as a therapist, what would you advise? I hope there are some therapists listening to this episode. What is your advice to therapists who have marginalized clients? What would you tell them when they tend to their clients, especially in such a divided era?
Mm-hmm. I think to make space for understanding their client's worldview. So asking them and not assuming, though. I think sometimes we can assume that because someone holds a marginalized identity that they are impacted. Some, you know, again, not a monolith, but I do think we need to, as therapists, acknowledge the possibilities, name what's happening either locally, nationally, globally, right? To bring it into the space, to show that you're actually paying attention and have a sense of that this could be impacting you. I think that really shows clients that you care and you're paying attention, because you can be, like, as a therapist, a really just kind of passive participant, but I don't know how helpful that is to clients. I do think clients need to be seen and understood. And if you can kind of name things that are maybe happening, I think that can go a long way. And it can open up a dialogue with your client that they may not be safe bringing up, especially if you don't have a shared identity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you haven't, like, had those conversations previously. So I think making space. I also think really being humble in who you are as a person. Like, I hate therapist who like posit themselves as the expert and they have to diagnose. Like, I think a lot of our system in mental health is based on people suffering and it's based on systemic oppression. So we often in mental health blame individuals without looking at this larger system that's actually causing a lot of the illness and lack of well-being. I think even being able to name that you're operating under systems of oppression and you're kind of moving through that and trying to be a healthy individual in these broken systems can really take some of that maybe stigma that people feel when they're not feeling their best, right? That it's really, you're doing the best you can in a kind of not so fair world.
Yeah, you're kind of like validating them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for such great advice for our listeners today.
Yeah.
And honestly, I also got a lot of amazing advice from you, what I can do in my daily life to be a better and healthier human being. Mm-hmm. Also, I should not have watched Civil War. For real, I should have talked to you first. I would have been like, oh my God. Yeah, no. If you have too much happiness in your lives, if you are like so super happy that you're like, oh my God, you should go watch because it'll kind of balance it out.
Reality check.
Yeah. But I mean, if you're delusional, sure, you should go. But if you're like a normal person being affected by normal stuff in your normal life, well, like, yes, you should probably, you know, go on your good days.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. Fair warning. My son would probably be, this is probably rated R, but it sounds like something he might be interested in.
Yeah. Once he hopefully understands that this is fiction right now, at least.
Right now. Yeah.
So nice to have you, Lisa, in my studio today.
Yeah, thank you, Ankita.
You've been listening to Subtle Desi Traits, a monthly show right here on WORT Madison. I'm your host, Ankita Bharadwaj. Coming up in a few minutes is Strictly Jazz Sounds. But first, the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.